Welcome to Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. I'm Bonnie Wolfe. Fall is bittersweet in the kitchen. The farmers markets are bursting with final color, but we know it won't last long. Food writer Susie Chang offers a menu of fall soups to help with the transition. And does anything go better with soup than grilled cheese? What kind of cheese? We'll talk about it all. So, let's dig in. Susie Chang is a New England-based freelance writer and reviews cookbooks for the Boston Globe. She has written a piece on fall soups for NPR's Kitchen Window Online. She joins me today. Hi, Susie.
Hi, Bonnie.
So you are a transplanted New Yorker who's finding yourself in the cold wilds of New England. Is this how you got interested in making soups earlier and earlier in the year?
It's true. I start thinking about it in, you know, early September, the second that you get the first hint of cold in the air. But fall soups are just this wonderful solution in so many ways. It's a one-pot meal. It warms you up. It's cheap. It's filling. It feeds a crowd. And it freezes. So you can not only feed a crowd, but you can feed one person for a week very easily.
What pantry staples do you need to have if you want to whip up a soup at the last minute?
Well, that's the great thing about fall soup. You really don't need much. It's probably the easiest soup you can make. You always have onions, celery, carrots, garlic in the house, most likely. If you have those, you can probably make fall soup.
What is your feeling about homemade versus store-bought broth?
Oh, you know what? I don't think it matters a great deal. If you're the kind of person who makes broth, that's great. You know, use it. It'll taste great. But you can even use water as long as you season it properly, use a little salt and pepper. You know, this is really like making stone soup. You can make it out of anything.
This is wonderful news.
Yes, yes, it is.
Do you freeze soup?
You know, I would, but I make 8 or 10 cups at a time, you know, and it's still gone. If not the first day, it's usually gone the second or third. I eat soups all the time for lunch. In fact, today I'm going to have squash soup for lunch.
What kind of squash do you use in the soup?
I think it's pretty flexible. I like using butternut because it's so easy to use, especially, you know, you can buy it already peeled and chunked up, and that's terrific. But you could use acorn, you could use kabocha, you could use Hubbard, you could use delicata, you can use red curry. I made one with that last night.
And ooh, what did you made a red curry?
Red curry. It's actually it's not curry, but curry.
Curry. How do you spell that?
K-U-R-I. It's this gorgeous flame red bumpy pumpkin, basically, and it's, you know, about the size of your head. And it's just got this gorgeous color. It's beautiful, and it's really tasty.
And do each of the squashes have a slightly different taste?
Oh, probably. But, you know, I just use them interchangeably.
And you don't change seasonings depending on the squash?
You know, I might just for fun, but, you know, I think that the, like, for example, the sugar pumpkin would be a lot sweeter, you know, a cooking pumpkin than using, say, a delicata squash. But so I might go a little more spicy with the sweeter ones, and I might go more buttery and cumin-y and, you know, smoky with the more savory ones.
Do you sort of make them up as you go along?
I do. In fact, the best fall soup I ever made was probably a roasted pumpkin soup I made years and years ago. And of course, you know, I just completely wung it. So I don't have the recipe, and I'll just have to try and make it up again someday.
What was so good about it?
I think it was just the caramelization of the pumpkin and the butteriness and the, I don't know, whatever I use, cumin or lime or something like that. It just had those sweet, mellow, earthy pumpkin flavors. In fact, you know, all fall soups have these fantastic ingredients that have these lingering, dark tastes that just stay with you and fill you up and make you feel warm inside.
What are some of those ingredients that
give? Well, besides the pumpkins, there's mushrooms, right? And there's bitter greens. I like.
Now, back to mushrooms for a second. Are you talking about wild mushrooms, domesticated mushrooms, a certain kind of mushroom?
The mushroom soup I talk about in my story is based on dried porcini, so it always feels like it's a real treat to me because they're a little bit expensive. But the fact is, mushrooms are great. You can use button mushrooms. You can use crimini. You can use whatever you can get. And I used to be a real wild mushroom snob, but not anymore. Now I realize that, you know, if you cook them correctly, you can get flavor out of just about any mushroom.
And what about dried mushroom versus fresh mushroom?
If you have dried mushrooms, use them because they really amplify the flavor, especially in mushroom soup where chances are you're using water rather than chicken stock. What you do is you soak the dried mushrooms in boiling water, and then you have this wonderful flavored mushroom stock that you can use instead of chicken broth, which gives us a wonderfully light mouthfeel, yet an incredibly dense and smoky and delicious taste.
So actually, dried mushrooms work better for soup.
Well, I like to use a combination, actually. The dried mushrooms for the broth and the flavor, and the fresh mushrooms, which I, you know, actually sauté a little bit first, just for texture and also for flavor.
What is your favorite fall soup?
It might be mushroom soup. I love them all. It's so hard for me to say, but I love any kind of mushroom soup. I like this wild mushroom soup that's in the story. I like cream of mushroom soup. I love cream soups, although I haven't actually mentioned those in this particular piece. But I adore mushrooms, and I can't get enough of them. I'm like a hobbit.
And what else are ingredients that are particularly available in fall, the sort of end of summer?
Oh, yes. Well, you can really get beans, and you can get lentils, bitter greens. And any of those root vegetables, your onions, your celery, your carrots, your garlic, your potatoes, all of them make great soup.
You serve this as a one-pot meal. Do you serve anything else with it?
Well, that's the beautiful thing about it. If you are, you know, we've talked in the past, I know, about what a lazy cook I am. And the thing is that if you make fall soup, you can do it in one pot, and then you can just have, you know, a glass of wine, piece of good bread, and that's a meal. And they're so filling that you really don't need anything else.
Sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
In addition to nutrition and warmth, you seem to have a sort of emotional feeling about soups in the fall.
I think that people should know that not only is soup easy to make, it's one of those things that you can do to make your life a little better, but that you don't usually think of doing, like putting on a pair of warm socks. You know? It's like when it's cold and the trees are bare and, you know, you feel lonely in that kind of basic existential way. Soup is just this wonderful way of filling up the holes.
That's wonderful. Susie, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That was food writer Susie Chang. Homemade soup makes me think of grilled cheese sandwiches because my mother always served them with a bowl of soup at lunch when the weather changed. Grilled cheese sandwiches are now haute cuisine, even served at fancy restaurants. Marlena Spieler, the author of Grilled Cheese, 50 Recipes to Make You Melt, joined NPR's Jennifer Ludden in the NPR kitchen in 2004 to show her some combinations my mother never thought of.
The essence of a grilled cheese sandwich is the bread and the cheese. But then you got your condiments. And you know, to me, a grilled cheese sandwich is like a little black dress. It's like a pair of jeans. It's the basics.
It goes with everything.
But it's the little scarf. And it's the shoes and matching bag that make it perfect. So it's just all about the condiments.
Okay. What would you like to cook first?
The first one is going to be Jarlsberg, fresh rosemary, roasted red peppers, and garlic, of course, on sourdough bread. Okay, we're going to put some rosemary in. Is that divine or what? Oh, my God, fresh rosemary. And I'm just sort of tearing it because it's young and tender and beautiful. But you might want to cut it. And now I'm just going to put some Jarlsberg.
Big squares of it?
Big squares of it. Again, just so it fits, because if it doesn't fit and it gouches all over, well, the gouche is quite delicious when it gets all crispy, but it's also messy.
Do all cheeses melt?
Some of the pressed curd cheeses or the Hispanic cheeses don't melt. But if you combine them with a cheese that does, it's really good. Okay, roasted red peppers and a little bit of garlic, because I just think garlic.
Okay, well, actually, that's a little bit.
Actually, that's quite a bit of garlic, isn't it?
I recall that a lot.
I know. I hope you like garlic.
I love garlic.
Oh, excellent. Well, we'll just brush on some olive oil. This is extra virgin olive oil from California. Despite the fact that I have lived in Britain for a long, long time, I'm a California girl at heart.
And you're brushing that oil on the outside of both sides of the sandwich?
Both sides of the outside. And then we're going to put, okay, oh, can you hear a bit of sizzling going on? Oh, doesn't that sound good? Now we're going to cover it with the top, and it's going to sound even better. It's going to do its magic while it's closed.
Now, this is a panini grill. Explain for those who may not have discovered this yet.
Okay, you can make a grilled cheese sandwich on a frying pan. It's going to be better if it is weighted down a bit, so you can put a second frying pan on top of it. And I do that. Or you can get a panini maker, and it's really fabulous. You don't have to worry about two frying pans because it has a lid. And then it makes grill marks, which you can see beginning to form there.
It's kind of like a waffle maker, but with straight lines there for the panini. Why is it better if you have pressure from the top instead of just flipping the sandwich in the pan?
Well, you know, I've thought about that. And, of course, you can just flip it, putting a lot of cheese in this one as I make that second sandwich. And I think what it is that the pressure makes everything have contact at the same time. The bread is mushing into the cheese melts, the bread crisps, and it makes a more compact, cohesive sandwich. Should we start moving on to assembling another one?
What's the next one?
Okay, the next one is, let's go goat.
Love it.
And we're going to the streets of Paris. We're going to leave NPR studios and just teleport ourselves to the... Oh, yeah. I see the Eiffel Tower. And there's the panini shop right next to it. So it's perfect. Okay.
In Paris, paninis?
I know. Paninis are Italian. Oh, not paninis. Panini, okay? They're Italian. But, you know, the Parisians, they do pick up all the delicious things in the world, and then they transform it into something elegantly Parisian. And that's what they've done with panini. And you can go, what we're going to do is we're going to just have little ciabatta rolls. We're going to fill them with goat's cheese and a couple of different types of filling. Walnuts, you could have thyme, you could have olives, you could have tomatoes. And we're going to have green chili and cumin just because I'm from California.
I never would have thought of that at home, I have to say.
Well, it's such a good combination, goat's cheese with green chili and cumin.
I think the cumin.
The cumin's so great. Let's smell it. Should we go smell the cumin? Isn't that gorgeous?
Mm.
I think cumin smells like kind of a desert at midnight.
Yes.
Yeah, that's going to be good with our goat's cheese.
You mentioned ciabatta rolls.
Well, I did, but it could be any kind of French or Italian roll, relatively soft. And as long as it's relatively delicious, to be completely honest. So we've opened them up, hollowed them out just a little bit.
Now, what, you don't want all that soft part in the middle.
No, you know why? It's just, you know, logistics. It's just kind of physics. You just can't close them up. And there's no room for the cheese, and we would hate that. And we're putting a goat's cheese in. You want a softish goat's cheese. So we're talking Montrachet. This is a Boucheron. It's gorgeous. It's just gorgeous. I mean, the goats that went to the trouble of making this cheese, good goats. And so we're just...
And you're just packing it in there.
We're just packing it in.
You made a little hollow part when you took out the center of the roll, and now you're stuffing it with cheese.
And I just think the more cheese, the better, really. So what I have here for one of our sandwiches is fresh thyme. Mm-hmm. And this is a scratch and sniff program. And, you know, you can use dried thyme, too. But just crush it with your fingers.
Okay, now you're going to sprinkle that on the cheese.
Yeah, and with that one, we're going to put green olives. Now I'm closing them up and pressing a bit.
And now you're laying out
a little bit of roasted green chilies and a little bit of cumin.
Oh, I smell them.
Nice, huh? And they're very mild. So we've got that one. And on the second one, we're just going to put some walnuts. Here they are, beautifully toasted. A small handful. And we're going to put some tomatoes on that.
Tomatoes on the one with the walnuts.
Yeah. So we've got our three goat's cheese sandwiches ready to go in. Brush them with the olive oil. It helps crisp them up. Okay, I'm putting that on. You can hear it sizzle. And then we'll close it on up. And I'm just turning these goat's cheese sandwiches
over. Now, why are you turning them? Because you've got the panini grill here.
Despite the fact that you have the heat coming from the top and the heat coming from the bottom, the cheese goes in one direction only, and that's down.
Oh, so it would just be a big puddle if you didn't flip it back.
So I like to flip it a bit. So those are looking good. And they are almost ready for us to taste. Listen to how crispy the outside gets. So that is looking really good. Look at that.
That's a lot of cheese in there.
That's a lot of cheese. Yeah. I better take a bite, too, because I want to be sure that I'm giving you something really, really good. So we'll bite together. Oh, did I just baa like a goat?
That is great. Goat cheese.
That's so good.
It is like a guilty pleasure.
Oh, God.
These are all delicious.
Oh, it's been so much fun.
Marlena Spieler, author of Grilled Cheese, 50 Recipes to Make You Melt. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now we can eat it all, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was author Marlena Spieler with NPR's Jennifer Ludden. Maytag blue cheese might be great grilled on bread because it's great on everything, in my humble opinion. Yes, Maytag makes washers and dryers, and for almost 70 years, they've made millions of pounds of creamy blue cheese by hand. NPR's Greg Allen reports.
60 years ago, Iowa wasn't the place to find exotic cheeses, but that didn't stop Fred Maytag, then president of the well-known appliance maker and owner of a small dairy farm in central Iowa. Fred's son, Fritz, says his dad may have begun making another type of cheese at Maytag Farms. But as it happens, researchers at Iowa State University had been studying one particular type of cheese that at that time had never before been made in the U.S.
It was the fact that they had a blue cheese recipe or some good ideas about how to make a better blue cheese that led him to do the blue.
Today, Maytag Farms is just a short distance from the factory in Newton that still turns out washers and dryers. But while the appliance maker is now publicly owned, the dairy farm remains very much a Maytag family business. Many of the employees have worked here for decades. They make 1 million pounds of blue cheese each year, and they do it the same way as when the plant opened, almost entirely by hand. Maytag Blue is creamy and a bit salty, and Myrna Verplug, Maytag Farm's president, says its flavor is not like other blue cheeses.
I have not found another one that I can say has anywhere similar taste. And again, I don't know if it's the local milk, the hands-on process, if it's the old tears and the old caves, and I don't know what adds to that flavor.
The flavor starts with the milk, all produced by local dairy farms. It's heated here in a warm, humid room in 2 long stainless steel 1,000-gallon vats. Rennet is added, which curdles the milk. Workers stir and cut the curds, waiting for just the right moment to separate them out from the liquid that remains, the whey. Cheesemaker Bob Wodzinski reaches in and scoops out a handful of curds, testing the consistency to see if they're ready to go into the hoops that form the cheese into wheels.
We go by the firmness of the curd and also the pH or acidity of the curd. And combination of both, it's the art and the science of cheese making, and that tells us by feel and by chemical test when the curd's ready to hoop.
When the curds are ready, they're drained, mixed with blue cheese mold spores, and placed in the hoops. The wheels are later rolled in salt and covered in wax to protect them while they're aging.
This is one of the caves. This has the newer cheese in it. You can tell it doesn't have a lot of mold development on it yet. And it's got a real fresh, beautiful aroma.
Maytag likes to age its cheese for 6 months, though lately as demand has risen, Verplug says they've cut the aging time a bit. Rich Pirog says Maytag Blue's success is part of a larger trend, consumer interest in what he calls place-based foods. Pirog is with Iowa State's Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture. Today, while corn, soybeans, cattle, and hogs are the corner posts of Iowa's agricultural output, Pirog says Maytag Farms can be a model for producers looking for alternatives. It's an agribusiness that has developed a quality product, but that also has something more, a story and a sense of place.
People want that connection with their food. They do want to know where it's grown. They want to know how it's grown. And so a sort of a natural evolution of that is an affinity to foods that are characteristic to a certain place.
In Europe, place-based foods are common, and the European Union regulates geographic designations for everything from Parmigiano-Reggiano cheese to Radicchio. In this country, Vidalia onions are probably the best-known example. They're protected by a Georgia law that restricts use of the Vidalia name to onions grown within a 20-county area. Elsewhere in the U.S., place-based foods are still catching on. Place-based foods are something that Fritz Maytag cares about. At the plant, as he watches workers remove the wax from the aged cheese and cut the wheels into segments, Maytag says there's a reason blue cheese in Iowa tastes different from blue cheese made in Vermont or Wisconsin. It's because of something French winemakers call terroir.
By which, broadly speaking, we mean a combination of the soil and the weather and the culture and the food and the seasons and the whole thing, and that's something that has always appealed to me. I think if you know where something comes from, it's more enjoyable.
Maytag's success has helped inspire others looking for an alternative to commodity agriculture. Not far from Newton, a co-op of Amish dairy farmers has set up a small plant where they're now producing their own brand of Iowa blue cheese. Greg Allen, NPR News.
Thanks for listening to today's Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. Go to our website, npr.org/kitchenwindow, for more food stories and recipes, including some for grilled cheese sandwiches. Join us next time. I'm Bonnie Wolf.